clear. And the stillness is a deep dryness, stages of stillness. I read that craving for non-existence, vibhavadana, is also strengthening the idea of self. Yeah, I said that. Please explain. For many years, I often say to myself, I wish this is my last birth. After seeing kids struggling at school, marriages, divorces, peer pressure, all relatives die one by one, I just lose interest. Yeah, but the thing is, you are wishing that you don't get reborn. You are doing that. You are trying to control the process. All controlling, all desire, is what builds up this sense of self. And the more you try and control, the more you struggle, the stronger your sense of self is. That's why it's so difficult for people to let go. Because to let go, you have to disappear. I shouldn't have really said that, because that's actually giving almost like a game away. When I say let go, when you really let go, you think, you know, you've gone. There's no me here anymore. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I say on every retreat, I make my confession. I, Ajahn Brahm, cannot meditate. Ajahn Brahm can't meditate at all. Ajahn Brahm is a hopeless meditator. But when Ajahn Brahm disappears, when I let me go, then meditation is so easy. I have to disappear in order to let go. When I disappear and I let go, meditation is the easiest thing in the world. When I get involved in it, then I will control it. When it controls it, it never gets peaceful. So I just sit here, none of my business. I'm not an abbot anymore. I'm just a visitor. I'm disappearing. I'm a nobody. And then everything gets very still. I always make the point that in the Christian tradition, in the Middle Ages, there were two people, for me, who probably did get into these deep meditations, Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross. And the reason I say that is because their descriptions are not totally convincing, but they are suggestive. They got into these jhanas. And I can understand why they did, because they were surrendering themselves to God. That was their path. Letting go of their personal control, desires, wants, and everything. Giving up to something bigger than them. It was letting go. No controlling, no craving. God take over. Now that would work up to a point. Because you're disappearing. So actually, to let go, you have to somehow have the faith, the courage to disappear. You come back again afterwards. You haven't lost anything. Except a lot of suffering. But just to let go and stop controlling. Imagine yourself disappearing. There's no one to do any controlling anymore. So it is true, the opposite, controlling, creates the self. Letting go allows it to vanish. Ajahn Brahm, you talk a lot about body-mind relationship. Could you please, as a Buddhist and a scientist, explain in what part of our body is the mind located? It's in my toe. This one over here. Disprove it. Whatever. From neuroscience, we know about the functional specialization of our brain, but no one has so far located where the mind is. Is the idea of mind only our cognitive imagination, product of our fantasies? If mind is not located in our body, then we can talk about a relationship between mind and body. The answer is your body is located in the mind, not the other way around. You're materialist. You think of stuff. Buddhism starts with mind. And the answer to that is in opening the door of your heart that... Did I say this first of all about my university friend's daughter? I said that recently somewhere. University friend's daughter, only 5 years of age, in grade one at school. Teacher asked them the question, what's the biggest thing in the world? One kid put their hand up, my daddy's the biggest thing in the world. Another one said an elephant, another one said a mountain. And the daughter of my friend, and who is now doing postgrad work in neuroscience, biochemistry, in Oxford. Brilliant girl. This is when she was in grade one. She put her hand up and said, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. No one, not even the teacher, understood what she was getting at. Explain. Well, said this five-year-old genius, my eye can see her daddy, and my eye can see a mountain, and my eye can see an elephant, and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. It's absolutely brilliant. It's just looking at things in a slightly different way. And when he wrote a letter to me and told me that, I said, brilliant, but not quite. 9 out of 10, but not 10 out of 10. Because your mind can see everything your eye can see. And your mind can imagine things you'll never see in the real world. Your mind can hear real and imaginary sounds. It can smell, it can taste, it can know feelings, real and imaginary. And your mind has got its own area of thoughts, fantasies, will. In fact, everything you can ever know can fit into your mind. So your mind is the biggest thing. Notice I never said biggest thing in the world. You can know the world, therefore the world can fit into your mind. So that answers the question. Where is the mind located? Wrong question. The body's located in the mind. Space, the universe, is located in your mind. That's why you can't point to it. The mind is the biggest thing. It's a brilliant argument, and no one has ever managed to refute that. It just comes from a different angle and totally answers all the questions. He once told a story about a man in the middle of a well and in a very dangerous situation, but he still enjoys the honey dripping from above. How does he manage to do that? It's very difficult to be in a difficult situation but still enjoy the present moment. I also want to learn to do that, but how? Well, that's that wonderful story. It's an old story, but I wrote it, added a few things in opening the door of your heart. There was a man. He was running through the jungle one day, being chased by a tiger. And there's two things you must know about tigers. Number one, they run much faster than you can. And number two, you are their dinner. So the guy was in big trouble. And the tiger was catching up on him. And he saw a well in the middle of the forest. He had no choice but to jump in. Otherwise the tiger would catch him. But as soon as he committed to jump, he saw it was a big mistake. Because that was a dry well. There's no water in the bottom. But except in the bottom, there was a big black snake. Imagine the bottom of the well with a snake. Now that is trouble. Fortunately, intuitively, he grabbed onto something on the side of the well. It was an old tree root. And that managed to stop his fall. When he came to his senses, he was only halfway down the well. But the fall, the sound, had disturbed the snake. And the snake had lifted up its head, opened it, sort of, trying to bite him on the feet. But his feet were just slightly too high. The snake was stretching, but just couldn't reach his feet. He was too high. And the tiger hadn't given up either. The tiger was leaning over the well, trying to paw him from above. But his hand was just too low. The tiger couldn't quite reach. And as he was coming to his senses, it was safe for the time being, he noticed two mice come out of a hole in the well, a black mouse and a white mouse, and they began to chew at his root, making it thinner and thinner. He was not going to last in this situation. And you all know the dark mouse and the white mouse, night and day, time. But the tiger was leaning over. And as he was trying to paw him, the back of the tiger was rubbing against the tree, making it shake. And on a branch of the tree, overhanging the well, there was a bee's nest. And because it was shaking, honey started to drip down. And so he put out his tongue and enjoyed the honey. And that was the end of the story. And I like that story as it was told, because that's real life. Real life is sometimes like you're between a deadly snake and a tiger, and your grasp on safety is being chewed away by the hour, by the mice. That's life. But a wise person can always enjoy the honey. Mmm, that's delicious. Why? Because you never know what's going to happen next. And in my ending of that story, which is possible, it's feasible, it might happen, the tiger leaned over a little too far, lost its balance and tumbled into the well, past the man on top of the snake, crushing the snake to death and breaking its own neck, thereby allowing the man to climb out at his leisure. And that's the unexpected happens in life. Sometimes, you know, you think you're going to die and you don't. And you get, and all those moments, all that honey you could have eaten and enjoyed, you miss because you're anxious and afraid. That's the meaning of the story. Anxious and afraid. Oh, I'm going to die. Something's going to go wrong. That stops you enjoying life. If you do die, wait for it to happen. Hasn't happened yet. Who knows what's going to happen? Please explain about four foundations of mindfulness. That has to be another one because that's a huge talk. It would be too late. So all these other ones, I will do them sometime. Until I do them, please enjoy the honey. I am currently going out with a younger woman. It was going very well until I met her mother. Best not to do that. I'm currently going out with a younger woman. It was going really well until I met her mother. Her mother and I hit it off really well and are closer in age. Maybe I should not go on with it. Yeah, I think I know where this comes from. So her mother and I hit it off really well and are closer in age. I would like to stop dating the daughter and further my relationship with the mother. How do I accomplish this without causing disharmony within the family? It's very easy. The only thing you can do to accomplish this without causing disharmony within the family is become a monk. Because if you go out with the mother, you're going to really upset the daughter. If you go out with the daughter, you're going to upset the mother. If you don't go out with anyone, you're going to upset yourself. So become a monk and you don't upset anybody. That's the answer to the question, because I know where that came from. And that's not the question he wanted, the answer he wanted. So that's the only way to overcome that problem. I think there's somebody in here who makes up these questions every time they come in, just to see how I'm going to answer. I think the last time you did one about a mud wrestling lesbian. Anyway, what is the meaning of the stuffed lion and bear by the altar? That's when you actually get into jhanas and you get wisdom, then you will know the meaning of the bear and the lion. Until that time, that is a mystery. Now, what it is that sometimes people have a hard time in meditation. You're here for 9 days and you have these times, just nothing works. And if nothing works, then you're supposed to do teddy bear meditation. Ping pong, could you give me the teddy bear and I'll show you how to do teddy bear meditation. So if you're really having a hard time and you're getting frustrated, nothing's working, thank you. So you put your teddy bear in this. You put your hands in front like this. And then you meditate with a nice little teddy bear. Now, you may laugh, but please try it. It actually works. Because, you know, the whole idea of cuddling a teddy bear, you can take a photograph. You had a photograph of the last teddy bear which I had. Now I'm going to lose my reputation. I've already lost it, so who cares? That's one nice thing. When you lose your reputation, you only lose it once. So get it over and done with, and then you're free to do whatever you want. So if you hug the teddy bear, straight away it gives you this beautiful sense of security, safety, kindness, nice and soft and cuddly. And it brings this beautiful sense of happiness to the meditation. So you're here and you're meditating with the teddy bear, and straight away it's so easy to be peaceful and to be kind and to be, you know, make peace, be kind, be gentle. And you're not making it so serious. Because it's serious, you've got something to attain. You have much more peace when you do teddy bear meditation. And we started this, I think, in Hong Kong a year or two ago. I went to Hong Kong, and this guy was very smart. He brought his two teddy bears. And those two teddy bears, people borrowed them. And, you know, every time they weren't there, you had to queue up and put your name on a list to borrow the teddy bear. That's how popular it was. And at the end, had all these really rich people. They tried to buy that teddy bear, you know, for thousands, 10,000 Hong Kong dollars, whatever. He would not sell them. So we had another teddy bear here. There was on one of the retreats. Someone had bought the teddy bear for their kid, and they put it up here. That was a big mistake. And so afterwards, it became the Jhana Grove teddy bear. And so we had that up here for a while. And people loved it. And they would borrow it, and they'd meditate with it. Or if you really get upset, take it to bed with you and cuddle it and have a really nice night's sleep. And bring it back in the morning so someone else can do teddy bear meditation. And then what happened was that I think somebody else wanted it so much, they said, we'll give you another one, and this is a replacement one. That was only in October, the old teddy bear. This is the second teddy bear, or the third teddy bear. I think one also got auctioned. That was Ajahn Sujato's teddy bear. So this is teddy bear number three?
Yeah,
three. Three, okay, the third teddy bear. And so if you want to try it, it actually does work. In the morning, in the afternoon, just get the teddy bear and meditate. Get yourself nice and comfortable and cuddle it. It's so nice, it's so easy to meditate. So that's how you do teddy bear meditation.
Someone kindly brought the lion to...
Do the same?
To do the same.
Yeah, but lion is... not the same. I like teddy bears, but if you like lions instead, you can do lions, do both. So now, I am actually, you're laughing, but be serious. Try it during this meditation retreat, and it brings back all these beautiful memories, you know, being a kid again, being your happiness, being your peace, and you get really great meditation with this. So that's what these ones are for. And thank you really, could you repeat it for at least 17 seconds? Thank you, thank you, thank you. Now I receive it straight away. That's what I often say in retreats, any praise for this retreat, the teachings, the accommodation, please come tell me. Any complaints, please see Dania or Bianca. You study theoretical physics. How do you explain levitation in meditation in terms of science? Thank you. You interfere with the quantum zero field, which means that the law of gravity is suspended and you levitate up and up and up and up. But you must really be careful, because when you meditate, always don't disturb it until you've landed. Because they have this classic story, anyway, another nice story, I forget where this was, in some commentary somewhere, there was a monk who lived over in the jungle somewhere, and great meditator, just something which happens after a while, you learn how to levitate. His mistake was he let someone see him. If you do levitate, keep it to yourself. So he would actually go for a morning sort of levitation around the jungle every morning, just for a bit of exercise. And one villager hunting in the jungle saw him levitating and told everybody else. And of course the word gets around. And the people in the village heard this, and then they actually saw him, so they told the people in the town. People in the town told the people in the city, and eventually got to the king. And the king said, I always wanted to see someone levitating. So he sent one of his generals, minister first of all, to invite the monk to come to the palace to show the king how to levitate. And the monk said, I'm not interested in going to the city, I'm not going. So the minister had to go back. So the next time he sent his army out there. To tell the monk, you have to come. So the monk had no choice but to go into the city. And the king was very sensitive. He said, look, I've planted a little forest in the grounds of my palace and a little hut in there. And it's just like the forest, only it's in my palace. And the king of Thailand did that years ago, because I remember visiting this little forest, about 1 acre of forest he'd planted in Chitlada Palace with a little monk's hut in there, because he wanted forest monks to be in his palace so he could offer alms to them and ask them questions if he needed to. It was so similar to this story. And I went to see Lumpu Lien, who was there. And it was just in the palace, but inside the forest, you could have been in the northeast of Thailand. It just made it just so authentic, so the monk would feel at home. So in this story, the king made this wonderful little hut in the forest for him. And he said, I want to come and ask you questions or just get some merit by offering you food. And so the monk agreed. Everything was going okay until one day he was going on his morning exercise, through the air. And this morning, the king himself didn't, bring the food for the monk. He sent one of his princesses, his daughters, who was drop-dead gorgeous. And she was bringing the monk's food for him, he saw her. And just sight of a beautiful woman, he had one moment of lust, and he lost his ability to fly when he was up in the air. He had to do crash landing. And he realized just how sensitive levitation is. So he had his food, and then he walked back to the forest. It didn't matter what the king would do to him. He was leaving. And it took him 2 or 3 years to get back to that state of meditation where he could fly again. But he realized that in the city there was too much sensory pleasures. People dress up and be provocative. So he needed to go and live with the animals in the forest to get his meditation back. So if you do learn how to levitate, don't go levitating over, say, Cottesloe Beach, where all these young girls in bikinis will cause you a lot of problems. What are relics? I'm a relic. Anyone over 50 is a relic. Can someone who isn't an arahat turn into relics upon cremation? That what happens is people get cremated and they go through the bones to see if there's any relics. And especially if you've got a teacher who's got a reputation. I'm sure you're going to do this to me. When I die, you can make me go looking. Are there any relics? See if Ajahn Brahm really was an arahat or not, or whether he was a fake. And you go through looking for all these relics and stuff. And it's just absolutely ridiculous and stupid and nonsensical. Because the Buddha actually said, be an heir to my Dhamma. Don't be an heir to material things. In the Dhammadhyata Sutta, he said, don't be an heir to my material stuff. But still, people have lots of relics around. And yes, sometimes there are some fascinating stories where, I've seen relics multiply, which is weird. The most common of supernatural phenomena in Buddhism, you put these relics in these containers, you count them one day and you count them another day and they've increased. I've seen that. It's no explanation at all, but it does happen. And even for my group over in Singapore, all business people, professors and stuff who've got don't believe in that sort of stuff at all, but I brought them over some relics once from Burma, and they called me just about a week after they got them. There's two little bones of Moggallana, and they said, there's three there now. And they haven't got a clue how they could have got into that sealed container. So sometimes it does happen. But my favorite story of relics is from the Tibetan tradition. And it's great because it says much more about relics than anything else. There was a fellow whose mother was a devout Buddhist living in Lhasa. And he was a business guy, so he would do import-export. He would take Tibetan goods, go over the passes when they were passable, where it wasn't too much snow, sell them in India, and buy stuff in India, bring them back to Tibet and sell them there. Import-export. And one day he was about to set off to India with some goods to sell. And his mother told him, he said, India is the place where the Buddha lived. Can you please bring me back some relics of the Buddha? And being a dutiful son, he said, yeah, sure, Mum. And being a typical son, he forgot. So when he came back, his mum said, have you got the relics? Sorry, Mum, I forgot. I'll get you the next time. That's what they always say. The next time he went over to India and he forgot again. Business is very busy and he got lots of deals to make. It just slipped his mind. And when he came back, oh God, I've forgotten again. And he told his mum, look, the next time I will certainly get you some Buddha relics for you, your shrine. But the same thing happened again, he forgot. And he was just going over the pass, he could see his hometown in the distance, you know, from above. He thought, oh my goodness, I've forgotten a third time. This is my mother and I respect her. I can't just say I haven't got anything. What am I going to do? And as he was thinking how to get out of that situation, he noticed on the path, just down a little bit from where he was standing, there was a carcass of a dead dog. So he thought, oh mother, this silly old woman, she won't know the difference. So he got a little bone of the dog. It was a dog bone. And in order to trick his mum, he got this expensive piece of cloth, which he was going to sell, but, you know, it gets him out of a problem. And he wrapped up this bone in this expensive, you know, cloth. Because a lot of time, if it's got good wrapping, we think it's really worth a lot. So, and when he came into the house, the mother said, you've forgotten again, haven't you? He said, Mum, here you are. And his mother was so overjoyed, had this little bone, which she thought was a Buddha bone. It was a dog bone, but she didn't know. She was so happy. Thank you, son. She had a little shrine. She put it on a shrine, started worshipping it. And he thought, okay, Mum's happy. Now I can go off and do my business. So he went off and sold a few more stuff he got from India. And a couple of days later, when he came back, he saw this huge crowd of people outside his house. This is supposed to be a true story. And he said, what's going on? Is my mother okay? And people outside, it's a miracle, it's a miracle. Something strange has happened. And so he says, this is my house. So he burst in, and his house was full of monks. He said, this is my house, where's my mother? And because he was, you know, owned the house, they let him in. And there in the shrine, his mother and the very top monks were worshipping this relic, because rays of light were coming out of this relic. Was it a dog bone? Was it a Buddha bone? Was it someone's faith had turned a dog bone into a Buddha bone? It's amazing the power of the mind. What do you think? But that was a great story, which apparently is very true in historical records, of a person's faith, or maybe David's, changing a dog bone into a Buddha relic with all his incredible powers. Who knows? But that's my favorite relic story. And the last two questions, and then we can go to bed. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you've previously spoken about the time you used energy for meditation to overcome tiredness. It was before a charity concert in Singapore. I think you said that you knew you had to settle down into meditation within 10 to 15 minutes. What do you mean by that? Is there a window of time in which a meditation session can take off to reach a deep level? Now, what that was, my group in Singapore were having a concert, and I was performing in the concert as myself. Now, what actually happened? It was really cheesy, you know. People say so quiche, but people loved it. Had this person had a problem. It was actually called Open the Door of Your Heart, based on the stories in my book. And the part where I came in, this woman came in and said, oh, you know, she had a big problem with her husband. The husband had been unfaithful to her. You know, this is Chinese husbands. You know, it's tradition. You know that in Singapore they have mistresses. And she forgave him. And I know it's her father. She forgave her father for having a mistress and hurting her mother. And she was visiting her friend and said, how come? How come you could forgive him for doing that terrible deed? And then the girl said, oh, because a friend of mine gave me this wonderful book called Opening the Door of Your Heart by Ajahn Brahm. And the friend said, oh, wow, I'd always love to meet that Ajahn Brahm. And that's my cue to come on stage. If you're going to be cheesy, really go full cheese. And then I give a little talk about forgiveness and stuff. So I didn't write the script. You know, they just told me what to do. So, you know, Friday night talk over here, you go to bed late, really early in the morning to get to the airport, to get to Singapore, straight from the airport to give the show. And then another show in the evening, Saturday evening. So I was so tired. Well, I know that if you're really tired, all you need to do is to be still. It's not making energy, it's making stillness, because that's where energy comes from. So I make myself really, really still. Now, no messing around. totally stop. And then all this incredible energy comes up. That's actually, I'll mention that later on in the retreat. The more still you are, the more power and energy come up. And after 15 minutes of meditation, I was just like had a really strong cup of coffee. But coffee makes you just agitate. This is power for meditation. So that's what I do whenever I need to get a big boost. Here's the other question. The last question. Did that one already. I think this one over here. Where's it gone? Okay. Without the ego to be desiring, do the five aggregates of desire, do they simply unfold according to supporting conditions? Is there desire but no desirer? Okay, basically to have desire, you have to have somebody behind the desire. That's you. When you disappear, there's no one to do any desiring anymore. So the sense of self and wanting something, they all go together. One of the sayings of the Buddha, where there's a self, there's things belonging to the self. When there's things belonging to the self, you think that's what you control. When there's things belonging to the self, that shows there's a self in there. Where there's attachment, there's control. And there's desire. Those all go together. And it all comes from a sense of me. When there's no you there, there's no desire left. There's just compassion, kindness, but not wanting anything. Peace at last. There's no one to do any wanting. What do you want anyway when there's no one there? So that's the end of all suffering. And that's the end of this evening's Q&A. Your suffering is now ended. You can now go to toilets to end your suffering, to let go. and have a nice rest. Okay. Sadhu. 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 Have a nice night. See you in the morning. Some of the questions I answer funnily. Some of them are serious questions. Some I have to leave for another day. So hopefully I don't offend anybody. If I didn't answer your question with the seriousness it deserved, write it again. But please don't blame me. Blame Dania.